Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. Mark Twain is generally credited with the quip, "Everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it." The same can't be said about climate change, which has become one of our most contentious and complicated public policy controversies. It's also divisive. According to a recent Gallup poll, 62% of those polled worry about climate change a great deal or a fair amount, but 38% worry about warming just a little or not at all. What to do about it causes further disagreement, even among those very concerned about a warming climate. The question of how to best balance the use of fossil fuels and renewable energy sources takes up most of these debates, issues we will not get into today. But there are also disagreements about how to redirect the human diet to reduce emissions caused by raising food animals and methods of plant agriculture. The orthodox view among most climate change warriors argues that we should eat much less meat and dairy products, to the point that some countries have gone so far as to order farmers to cull their herds. My guest today dissents from those policy prescriptions, and he's written a major book detailing in depth why that approach won't work and charting what he considers to be a better path forward. Political journalist Michael Grunwald is the best-selling author of two widely acclaimed books, The Swamp and The New New Deal. He's a former staff writer for The Washington Post, Time, and Politico magazine. He is the winner of the George Polk Award for National Reporting and the Worth Bingham Prize for Investigative Journalism, among other professional honors. His current book is We Are Eating the Earth, The Race to Fix Our Food System and Save Our Climate. Grunwald believes that climate change is a crisis and caused by human activities. For the purpose of this interview, we are going to assume that his concerns are correct so that we have more time to explore his proposed solutions. Michael, welcome to Humanize.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're a political journalist. What got you interested in both politics and journalism?
Well, I was at the Washington Post. I was at Politico magazine, and I've written a lot about the environment. My first book was about the Everglades in my part of the world, and that meant writing about climate. But it had always been, it's been energy and climate, right? You know, there are 1,000 books about energy and climate. But I realized that agriculture is, it's basically our second biggest climate issue, food and agriculture, after energy and fossil fuels. But it's also a massive environmental issue. And if you don't care about climate, right, it uses 70% of our fresh water. It's the major cause of water pollution. If you don't like the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, or I guess now we're supposed to call it the Gulf of America, it's the leading driver.
We won't get into that.
Yeah, exactly. It's the leading driver of biodiversity loss and deforestation and wetland destruction. So a lot of things, even if for people who don't care a lot about the climate or think that that's just, you know, something that left-wingers have overstated, you still got to care about agriculture if you care about our planetary home, because as I say in the book, we are eating the earth.
It's interesting because most of us don't live in rural areas where food is grown and where farm animals are raised. And so, you know, we go to the store and we buy the steak that's in the wrapped package, and we buy the apples that, you know, somehow got there from the tree. And we don't think much about agriculture and its impact.
I think that's right, right? I mean, right. And even those of us who understand that our food doesn't kind of magically materialize on our grocery shelves, right? You take a cross-country flight and you look out the window and you see all those rectangles and circles, and you kind of think to yourself, wow, there's a lot of agriculture out there. But the kind of duh point of my book is that there is a lot of agriculture out there. You know, we hear a lot about how our cities and suburbs are sort of sprawling into nature. Well, that's maybe one of every 100 acres of habitable land on the planet, heading towards 2%, but right now it's about 1%. Farms and pastures are 40% of our habitable land, 2 of every 5 acres. And we are losing a soccer field worth of tropical forest to agriculture every 6 seconds. So this idea that agriculture is just kind of this, you know, this sort of thing out there, really, we live on this natural planet that is becoming an agricultural planet. And again, as I try to point out that, you know, whether or not you care about the climate, if you care about the earth, it is becoming a farm, and in many ways, an animal farm.
You know, I've read the book, and it's, I have to say, incredibly impressive amount of research. I know what that takes, having written books myself. How long did it take you to write the book, and what did you do to research for it?
Yeah, I mean, this was like a 5-year enterprise. And and for all the people who are yelling at me and calling me biased, the good news is that I came into this with absolutely no bias, because I came to it knowing absolutely nothing. I was really spectacularly ignorant. So it was just an extraordinary amount of reading, of reports, of interviewing. I ended up probably interviewing a couple thousand people for this book. And as you know, somebody who actually slogged all the way through it, you know that there is a main character. His name is Tim Searchinger, and I went to 4 countries with him. I joke that I've been on the phone with him for the last 5 years. So it really was an extraordinary amount of research, partly just to, you know, to know the facts before I could even think of how to analyze the facts. And this is an issue where I feel like energy and climate, you know, the world really, there's been a lot of work. There's been a lot of study. People kind of know the issues. And in fact, there's, you know, if you care about this stuff, there's been massive change where we are having this clean energy revolution around the world, where 95% of the new power plants built around the world last year were either wind or solar or nuclear or some other zero emissions type of thing. While on the food side, like, not only don't we know the answers, we don't even know the questions, and we really haven't made any progress. So my feeling was the world wasn't really grappling with this stuff. Say what you will, yell at me all you want, but I grappled. And now I'm trying to get other people to grapple.
You certainly grappled. And I think you've accomplished something that's rare. You've probably angered just about every faction in dealing with these issues, because you do take a heterodox perspective, which is one of the things I like about the book. It's not just putting out the talking points. It really reflected, whether one agrees or disagrees with all of your conclusions, it really reflected a lot of thought, a lot of research, and a lot of consideration. It hit me that...
You know, Steve Bannon, I did Steve Bannon's show, and he said to me, "Man, Grunwald, everyone's going to hate you." Exactly. And I told him that maybe I would put that as a blurb for the paperback edition.
I think that would be a great blurb. You treat agriculture almost as if it's a predator. That was what struck me, that it is predating on the natural world, which you believe and write we need in order to counter the increased carbon dioxide and so forth in the atmosphere. Do you think of agriculture in that sense?
That's an amazing statement, and I had never thought of it exactly that way. I do have a line that you know, I've gotten some grief for, where I do say that every farm is a kind of environmental crime scene. It's a sort of echo of the nature it replaced. And so in that sense, I do kind of make the point that agriculture makes a mess. And that's not, you hear a lot of environmentalists say, like, it's industrial agriculture. No, it's agriculture. Agriculture has always made a mess for 12,000 years. It had deforested a South America worth of land even before the Industrial Revolution. But the flip side is, we got to eat. It's not making the mess for no reason. Well, I try not. So predator, I think, is sort of a, you know, it's a kind of nasty word, right? And it implies that that people are doing something terrible when they are transforming our natural planet into an agricultural planet. And what I would say they are doing is that they are businessmen, and they are meeting demand. And some of them are some of the poorest people on the planet. right? There are 600 million smallholder farmers who are farming just to survive. So I try to not be judgmental or scoldy about the impact that agriculture has. But I also think that, you know, we've got to be grownups about it. And in the United States, our politics on the right and the left, there's this sense that farmers are these sort of heartland saints. And because they're, you know, because they have such beautiful morals and they're such hardworking people, that we should treat their businesses different than other small businesses and big businesses. And I'm sort of saying, like, hey, you know, here's this extraordinarily important industry that it is indispensable for our survival, but is also making a huge mess. And so how can we help them make even more food? Because we're going to need 50% more food by 2050 to feed a growing population, but do it with less mess, because they can't keep using more land. We're on track to deforest another dozen Californias by 2050, and we don't have another dozen Californias worth of forest to spare. I mean, we are going to have to, if we're going to try to meet these, you know, our emissions targets in the Paris Climate Agreement, which I know not everybody cares about, but we're on track to go past 2 degrees warming. And even if we cut off all fossil fuels tomorrow, we're still on track to go past 2 degrees warming by 2050 if we don't fix our food and agriculture. So, you know, it's a big deal.
When it comes to population, I've been reading that we're having a plummeting childbearing, certainly in the West, in the United States and in countries in Europe and so forth. So are we really going to be in a situation where the population continues to grow and there would have to be that increased agriculture?
The short answer is yes through 2050. And that's partly because you are absolutely right, particularly in the developed world, but actually throughout the world, there's been a real decline in birth rates. And I talk in the book that we actually know how to bring a sort of, you end up sounding like Thanos when you say birth rates are too high, right? Like as if people are a bad thing. And I don't believe that. Like, you know, some environmentalists are kind of like, you shouldn't have kids. And I have two kids. And to me, that's what's made life worth living. I would never say that to people. But that said, like, for instance, right now, the main high birth rate issue is in sub-Saharan Africa, which is also, you know, the poorest part of the world, the highest infant mortality rates. You see often they're having 7 kids so that 3 survive. And you don't want people to feel like they have to have kids. But we know that if you educate girls, they tend to have fewer kids and they start having kids later. There's a sort of tried and true approach that's worked in Bangladesh, in Iran, in Botswana, and that has had a real impact on the projections, particularly for like 2100. But by 2050, because birth rates were so high for so long, there are just so many women of childbearing age that we might end up having 9.4 billion people in 2050 instead of 9.7 billion people. But we're going to have a lot more people.
And the problem with that, just to recap, is that in order to feed those people, which of course we want to do, you're going to have to clear a lot of land for agriculture, land that you think is needed to help sustain a healthier climate.
And I think, and particularly we want people in the developing world to have more money, to be less poor. And the first thing that human beings tend to do when they get less poor is to eat more meat. And right now, there are 6 billion people on Earth who eat practically no meat. And that's unfair. That's wrong. That's tragic. And that is gradually changing, particularly in China and India. But meat does have a much larger environmental impact. It uses much more land. You have to feed about 10 calories worth of grain or other plants to a chicken to get 1 calorie worth of meat. Because remember, that grain is supporting the feathers and the beak and the clucking and the pooping and all sorts of things that don't produce actual calories for us. And cattle, as you know, I write about in the book, they're the real baddies, and they use 10 times as much land as poultry or pork. They are really just spectacularly inefficient converters of their feed into our food. And so to me, it's like, it's not a sad thing that the developing world is going to be, you know, be able to afford meat in the future. That's a great thing, but it is something that we have to deal with if we don't want it to just devastate the entire Amazon and the Congo rainforest.
One of the things I often decry environmentalists about, at least the more radical ones, is it seems to me they're very content to leave destitute people in destitution. And I'm not, and I can tell by your book that you're not either. I want to get into the meat issue as well as the plant issues, but I do want to talk a little bit about Timothy Serchinger. I've never heard of this fellow. And you, I'm reading page after page of the things he's done and that he's contributed to in terms of the debate, and he's not even a scientist. Tell us about why Timothy Serchinger is so important in this discussion.
Tim is not a scientist, but he has now published 10 papers in Science or Nature, which are the two most prestigious scientific journals. I had one scientist wrote me a nasty email. He said that I was probably going to say that Tim was a better scientist than him just because he publishes in Science. I was kind of thinking, well, maybe. He's an interesting
guy. Turf protection to me.
Exactly. I mean, Tim's a fascinating guy. He was a wetlands lawyer, and he's a New Yorker, a kind of brash, sort of arrogant, you know, but very hardworking, very well-meaning, well-intentioned guy who is extremely passionate about getting to the truth. And when he was a lawyer, he ended up getting drummed out of an environmental group pretty much because he's the one who essentially figured out that biofuels, farm-grown fuels such as corn ethanol or soy biodiesel, which were 20 years ago when there was a new movie called Who Killed the Electric Car? People were, you know, the Al Gore's film had just come out and people were worried about fossil fuels. Biofuels were seen as the only real alternative. And Tim was the guy who recognized his own inconvenient truth that they're actually worse for the climate than fossil fuels. And the basic reason, not to get too deep into it, but is that if you grow fuel instead of food, you know, the world is still hungry. And so you're going to have to grow more food somewhere else. And it's not going to be a parking lot. It's going to be a wetland or a forest that, right, you know, not only stores a lot of biodiversity, but stores a lot of carbon. And so he started publishing about these very inconvenient notions that biofuels were not going to be the savior, even though at the time, a lot of environmentalists, as well as a lot of scientists, were really, really pushing it. And essentially, biofuels are eating about a Texas worth of the earth, and agriculture is eating 75 Texases worth of the earth. And Tim stumbled into this idea that, like, you know, land is the problem, and the initial climate studies that he was looking about for biofuels were essentially treating land as if it were free. They were ignoring land, the cost of land. And then he realized that basically looking at agriculture was doing the same thing. And that this was a massive problem that the world was not dealing with. And he was going to try to figure it out himself. So he became essentially the world's leading authority on food, agriculture, and climate issues. So in addition to being, I think, a kind of fun, interesting character to follow around, so I thought he was kind of a good spine for the narrative.
And I think it works because I found it totally unexpected. That was like, oh my, this is not taking the usual approach I expected
One other thing I should say about Tim that I think might be interesting for your readers is that a lot of climate, and particularly the energy and climate side, has become just a political story, right? It's about, like, you know, some people saying, like, you need to stop using fossil fuels, and other people saying fossil fuels are great, and some people saying, like, we need to cut carbon, other people saying, like, carbon is plant food. And I think a not very interesting political debate. While the food part of the problem is really so nascent in the way we're dealing with it, that it's not a political debate yet. I mean, though it's starting to get that way, but it's still an analytical debate. And Tim is an analyst. And so I thought it was really interesting following his intellectual journey as he, you know, I don't know if I can say it on your show, you can bleep it if I can't, but his thing is that we need to hurry the fuck up and figure shit out. And that's part of what my book is trying to do. And Tim was, I think, a great vehicle to sort of do it through.
Does he put that in his Princeton class manuals?
I think, you know, it certainly didn't make it into Science or Nature. I will say that.
You just said something that caught my attention, that he was drummed out. And that reflects something that I've been writing a lot about in my work, which is the ideological nature of some of these science journals and medical journals, that the editors have pushed a particular narrative. They believe it, but it seems to me that they get so biased that they might refuse to see something like what Searchinger came up with because it doesn't fit what they believe is right. And therefore, science gets stymied because science is about contesting issues and contesting facts and so forth to try to find what is actually true. Do you see that in this issue?
You know, I knew you would ask me this, and I thought about it a little bit because it's, you know, for people like me, it's a little uncomfortable because, you know, there are a lot of people who hate science and feel like, oh, science, it's all woke. It's all bullshit. It's all like, you know, it's just, and if I'm totally honest, sometimes there's a lot of trash science out there, and I write about some of it in the book, and I understand why some people are, they're skeptical of experts, right? Because sometimes the experts get it wrong. That said, there's also a reason that, you know, you don't want the random guy sitting next to you on the plane to fly it. And I think that some of the, and climate science in particular, and this has been a real problem on the right, is this idea that the, you know, just as you've discussing, and I think that there are a lot of kind of, there's a lot of woke science and there's a lot of wishful thinking in the scientific community, or, you know, this idea that we are going to overhype what we've found because we think that that climate is important. And so we want people to be scared and we want people to do more. And I think that's unacceptable. But then I think there's the similar kind of instinct where human beings don't like to have their priors challenged. And there's basically this idea that, like, you know, I don't like climate science. I don't like this idea that the world is getting hotter and it's because of us. So I'm just going to say it's all a hoax. And honestly, I think that's irresponsible. The basic climate science about what's happening to the planet is really solid, and is actually the modeling has been really good. It's been pretty impressive. And so I do think that there's a kind of throw out the baby with the bathwater aspect to some of this, but maybe I'm just dodging the question, because the answer is you're right. there are a lot of, and it is, you know, I wrote about it a lot in the bioenergy space, where you see a lot of these scientists who have sort of dedicated their careers to studying bioenergy and had never really thought about the land use angle. And I wrote about some of them who were kind of like, whoa, I missed it. I was wrong. But that's like, that can be a career killer. And so there are a lot of others who are kind of like, well, I don't like the messenger, or, you know, well, maybe, you know, they're trying to make it uncertain. And there's a lot of bogus science of people who, you know, are going to be, if bioenergy is really great for the climate, they're going to be much more important, and they're going to get to publish in more important journals, and they're going to get tenure at better universities. And I think that's, it's just a human thing to not want to admit that you're wrong. And I don't like it. And I kind of exposed it, and, you know, I made some people look pretty ridiculous, and they're pretty upset at me. But I think you're right to have your antenna up about it, because I do think on the left, there's this notion that if it's science, that it's gospel. And that's even a misunderstanding of science.
Exactly. Correct. Yeah. It's a problem, I think, because we need expertise, but you also, when you say, well, the experts get to decide, that's not how democratic societies are supposed to function. And there's also a problem, I think, with the media. And I don't know if you've experienced it with your book, because I haven't read any of the reviews, but there's a lack of nuance where the media likes to, it's black or white. And, getting into, like you do throughout this book, the various nuances is not their strong suit.
Yeah, it's not anybody's strong suit, yeah, if we're going to be honest, right? And this is part of the problem with even, you know, selling a book, as you know, right? You want there to be a tribe, right? You know, and you know, if I'd written a book about how the answer is everybody needs to go vegan, all the vegans would come out and buy it. And correct. If I'd written a book saying the answer is we just need, you know, regenerative agriculture, all the regenerative agriculture and foodie people and organic chefs or whatever would go out and buy it. But instead, I'm telling this kind of complicated story about how, like, yeah, we're going to have to, you know, eat less beef, but we're also going to have to make beef more productive. And that's going to mean some industrial agriculture, but also industrial agriculture is making too much of a mess. And they're going to have to clean up their act. And on the other hand, yeah. And people hate that shit. And it gets people really angry.
Life isn't simple. life isn't simple. And we have to understand that there are nuances and there are costs and benefits, and you have to make choices, and there are going to be consequences to some of those choices. I was a little surprised at the negativity toward ethanol, because I remember the days when ethanol was the solution, particularly for things like air pollution and in terms of particulate matter and this kind of thing. What's wrong with ethanol?
Well, ethanol, just there, I'm not nuanced, I guess. You know, ethanol sucks. You know, I guess the quick answer is just a spectacularly inefficient way to produce energy. You know, land is really great at storing carbon. It is really great at growing food. It's terrible at making energy. And in fact, a lot of the, you know, on the right and in rural America right now, you see this real backlash against solar and wind. And a lot of counties are banning solar and wind farms on farmland. And the argument they're making is, you know, though they don't put it in these terms, is that it eats too much of the earth, right? That it takes too much land. Well, an acre of solar panels makes as much energy as 100 acres of corn grown for ethanol. As I said, if you incorporate the land use of ethanol, it is a climate disaster. It's an environmental disaster. And it is just, it's pure politics. In the United States, we have these ethanol mandates, which require 15 billion gallons of ethanol to be blended into our gasoline every year. And every year it's 15 billion. It's not 15.0001 billion, because nobody in their right mind would make any ethanol that wasn't mandated. It's completely economically nonsensical.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. But again, it's, this is something where, because...
Is that why you need so many subsidies for it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's just another way of funneling money to farmers, which we have many ways of doing in this country, through direct subsidies and counter-cyclical subsidies and crop insurance subsidies and, you know, conservation subsidies. Biofuel subsidies are just another one. And this one just happens to be a particularly destructive one.
I think one of the strongest points you made, if you accept the thesis that we need to use less farmland, and you make a very strong case for that, that ethanol is corn grown for fuel instead of corn grown for people. And if we weren't using that corn for fuel, you would not have to till as much corn to feed people. I thought that was a very strong point.
That's exactly right. It's, you know, you're taking money out of, you know, poor people in developing worlds. You're taking corn out of their belly and putting it into an SUV. And it's really, it is immoral, as well as, you know, kind of bad public policy. And it's funny, in these climate analyses that now, you know, once Searchinger came out with his new science showing that that in fact the math didn't pencil out for biofuels, they immediately started coming up with all kinds of new crazy assumptions in their studies and their models to try to make it pencil out. And one of the ones, if you dig into the assumptions the way Searchinger has, their favorite way of doing it is their argument is that basically biofuel mandates will make and other grains so expensive, which of course is the point of them, right? The idea is to make grain more expensive so that farmers get more money, that it will make food too expensive and people in the third world will eat less food and breathe out less carbon dioxide. That is literally the argument if you dig into the numbers. And of course, yes, that is, I guess, a climate benefit, but it's a disaster. It's terrible. It's immoral. And it's
make hungry people even hungrier is what it sounds
exactly.
Like.
And that's what it does. I quoted that reggae song from 2008. It's called the Biofuel Song. And this is a time when biofuels were, and environmentalists were still pushing biofuels as the greatest thing on earth. And even some like random reggae star in Jamaica figured out that biofuels were driving hunger and deforestation. It's, the ethanol industry put out a list of their top 10 enemies. And I am not embarrassed to say that I was number one.
Man, I was going to say maybe you were number three, but number
one. No, I was number one. This was after I wrote a cover story in Time magazine about how the headline was the clean energy scam. I really feel strongly about this stuff. And now I should say that the big, beautiful bill, you know, the Trump's Republican big, beautiful bill, there is one, you know, it cuts $1 trillion worth of clean energy subsidies that I bet you and I could have an argument about. But it also has $50 billion in new subsidies for biofuels. And it's not to put it in our cars because electric vehicles are really, sort of making that obsolete. It's to put it in our planes. And in fact, I mentioned that this stuff doesn't pencil out. There's also language in the big, beautiful bill that essentially tells the government to put its pencils down. It says that when you decide whether these sustainable aviation fuels, that's the term of art, are actually sustainable, you cannot look at land use. You have to ignore the land use. And of course, the whole point of what makes it bad is the land use. But the whole point of why we have biofuel mandates and biofuel subsidies is because we want to increase the price of grain for us so that farmers make more money.
So you were talking about both sides of that, and it's thumbs on the scale on both sides. And it has to do with politics and not actual climate issues. You argue that big ag is a solution to the problem because of the efficiencies that large agricultural concerns can bring to growing food. Is there no place left for the small family farm?
Well, what I'm really an advocate of is high yield ag, right? We need to make more food per acre. Because then we don't need as many acres to make food. Then we eat less of the earth. And so I try to be at least somewhat agnostic on how we are going to have higher agricultural yields, higher crop yields, higher livestock yields. And in fact, some smallholder farmers, like the extreme smallholder farmers, they have pretty decent yields, partly because basically they're so poor that they don't need pesticides. They're weeding by hand, right? They replace, you know, a lot of the other inputs that you use in the rest of the world, they replace with labor. I'm not saying that's a great way for them to live, but it's just a way of saying that I'm not an advocate necessarily for big ag or small ag. I'm an advocate for productive ag. And of course, that's gotten a lot of pushback because all of the energy, particularly on the left right now, but also from Bobby Kennedy, from Joe Rogan, from a lot of voices on the right, is for this kind of regenerative and organic ag where the chemicals are the bad guys, right? You know, pesticides, boo, fertilizer, and this is all terrible. Instead, we want farms to be more natural. And I get it. There's this sort of romantic idea that farms should be, you know, kind of like our great grandfather's farms, right? There's, you know, the soil is treated with love and the animals have names instead of numbers. But again, the fact is, if it's not making as much food per acre and the average organic farm makes about 30 to 40% less food per acre, then it needs 30 to 40% more land to make the same amount of food. And that's an environmental disaster that isn't going to be felt by, you know, the yuppies living in Berkeley who are complaining about this stuff and saying we all need to go all organic. It's going to be people who suffer are going to be indigenous people in the Amazon and, you know, smallholder farmers in Africa and poor people living in the floodplains in Bangladesh. So again, I think there's a lot of high horse mentality about some of these things. And I'm just saying, like, these are math problems.
Speaking of creating enemies, you just had published in the New York Times a defense of Roundup.
Yeah.
So that went over big. Yeah, I bet that did. Tell us about the Roundup defense and what the reaction to your piece was, even whether the New York Times got a pushback for even daring to publish it.
Yeah. And again, good for them. I mean, I will say it was quite an editing process. But good for them for running it.
I've been through that myself, yeah, with the New York Times.
I think there's, there's this real movement right now that everything should be all natural, all organic, that, you know, we're being poisoned with everything, you know, every time we take a breath, every time we take a bite of food. And there are some bad stuff out there. But, I start with what they did in Sri Lanka.
Tell that story.
The president announced that they were going to go all organic and they were going to ban all agrochemicals. And that was wonderful until they actually did it. And 6 months later, their farm yields crashed and they were no longer agriculturally self-sufficient in rice. And they started having food shortages and food riots. And the president, you know, the president had to flee the country. The government fell. It was a total disaster. And again, this is not to say that there haven't been some pesticides that are really nasty stuff. But the reason I wrote about Roundup is because it is the most despised pesticide. That's where you have, you know, the Surgeon General of the United, or the nominee, Trump's nominee for Surgeon General, has said that it's a large scale extinction event, and has begged her followers not to buy Roundup. You know, Bobby Kennedy has said that it's, you know, it's poisoning America, and it is the most widely used pesticide on Earth in history. It's a people call herbicides are a type of pesticide, right? All insecticides, fungicides, and it's by far the most used. And then to top it off, it's almost always used on genetically modified crops because they've been modified to be, the term is Roundup ready. And so in other words, they resist glyphosate, which is the main active ingredient. Glyphosate is a really incredible weed killer and plant killer. So it wipes out everything else except for the crops.
Which increases yield and productivity, exactly, which is makes, your passion.
Exactly. And also, I should mention, replaces much nastier chemicals. It is the most benign herbicide out there. And the reason is because it's a plant killer. It acts by, it's on an enzyme that animals don't have. So it doesn't kill all the, you know, it doesn't kill the ladybugs and it doesn't kill us. And there are some, you know, you talk about bad science. You know, there definitely, there's been some scientific studies that where they just bombard rats with just unbelievable, you know, amounts of glyphosate. And they say that maybe it could be a pathway to cancer. And these are the same agencies that also say that being a barber is carcinogenic. And eating processed meat is carcinogenic. And it's like, yeah, if you just, you know, went on an all processed meat diet, but these studies really suck. They are giving rats millions of times more glyphosate than you will ever ingest from the residues in your, you know, in the corn or soybeans that you're eating. And so, yeah, I thought it was, I knew it wasn't going to be popular, but I thought it was important to say not only just that glyphosate and Roundup is okay when it's sprayed on crops and that people shouldn't worry about it, but that we need to start thinking about science seriously, that it has to be like that it's the dose that makes the poison, that we need to think about the costs and benefits of chemicals, that we can't just be like chemicals are bad, you know, no more chemicals.
I think the example you used was Tylenol.
Yeah, exactly.
Where, you know, you take a couple of Tylenol. I won't get into the Trump stuff going on right now.
Which now that's controversial too.
But you take a little Tylenol for a headache is different than swallowing the whole bottle, which can destroy your liver.
That's right.
Basically what you're talking about.
That's right. And Tylenol is more acutely toxic than glyphosate. Caffeine is significantly more acutely toxic than glyphosate. So I'm just trying to dispel some of the hysteria around this stuff because it really is, you know, and again, easy
trial
for me to
lawyers
say.
Are not going to be happy with you. Let's put it that
way. No. And remember, Robert Kennedy Jr. was one.
Yeah.
And he used to, you know, he made a lot of money suing Monsanto.
One too, by the way.
There's nothing wrong with trial lawyers. But the argument for a lot of, you know, most of the pushback has been like, well, if Roundup is isn't bad, then how come, you know, there are all these juries awarding billions of dollars to to people who claim they got sick from Roundup? And I'm like, because people like you keep telling them that it's bad.
And they have great sympathy for people who are going through a terrible situation.
I think that's right.
So juries have hearts, and sometimes they let their hearts get ahead of their heads.
Yeah, and who wants to defend? And here I am defending Big Ag, right? I must be a shill. I must be on the take.
That's right.
And in fact, I think you may have seen, I mentioned this, but I actually lost a speaking engagement from that Roundup article. They were very upfront. They were like, you know, that's kind of toxic right now. And we can't.
You've gone too far, Michael.
Exactly. I'm the only idiot who's actually lost money defending Big Ag.
I want to talk just a little bit about nuance, and then I want to get to the meat issue. You talk a lot about, well, the rainforest being destroyed and so forth, and the agriculture down in Brazil and that kind of thing. But a lot of agriculture isn't in Brazil. Can't we have different policies for places like Kansas and the Ukraine, which don't involve destroying rainforests?
Well, one of the things I like to point out is that Indiana used to be 85% forest. And so we already deforested our Amazon in the 19th century. And so it's very easy for us to kind of point our fingers at Brazil and Indonesia and say, like, you're bad, you're tearing down your forest. But what their farmers are doing is not significantly different than what our farmers are doing. It's just that they still have trees to knock down and wetlands to drain. Part of the reason I try to make this a global issue is this idea, and I'm really talking about a new land ethic, where if you are not, you know, if you are not making as much food per acre as you can on that acre, you are contributing to the eating of the earth, even if the deforestation isn't happening near you. So there was a front page story in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about Kernza, which is this regeneratively grown grain, perennial. So it's much more natural. It has much deeper roots. It doesn't require as much fertilizer and pesticide. And it's really great. Patagonia is pushing it. General Mills is going to put it in a cereal. The only problem with it is that it has 1/3 the yields of wheat, which means it needs 3 times as much land to make the same amount of grain. And that deforestation isn't going to happen in Kansas, but it's going to happen somewhere. And that's what I'm trying to point out, that this is a globally connected economy, that people need to eat everywhere. And in fact, as the population moves south, so is agriculture. And so we need to make as much food per acre in Kansas, and we need to do it in Ukraine, but we got to do it in Brazil too. And we shouldn't be dumping on farmers for being more productive. If anything, we should dump on them when they're less productive.
I think that's common sense. I was amused by
your... I don't know about common. Might be sense.
What we used to call common sense. I was really amused by your comment about indigenous people. One of the things that's driving me crazy about modern environmentalism is they keep repeating the trope, we have to listen to the wisdom of indigenous people. But indigenous people were pre-modern. Indigenous people did not have to feed billions of mouths. I love indigenous people. My great-grandmother was Cherokee. But that doesn't mean that the wisdom of indigenous people can serve the modern world and a world that needs to have a lot of electricity and mass production of food, as you've discussed. But really,
some indigenous people were very sophisticated farmers.
Of course.
And in fact, this is like one of the fun facts in my book, but I mean, maybe it's not fun. It's a little macabre. But the Great Dying after European contact, when through genocide and through disease, basically most of the indigenous people in the Americas were wiped out.
Smallpox, right.
That actually created measurable global cooling.
That's what I was going to get into.
Their farms were, they were rewilded, not on purpose, you know, not by somebody who said we need to save the climate, but they were, again, like people think of them like noble savages or primitive, but they were, you know, they had converted a lot of forest into farm. And after they left, a lot of that farm became forest again.
Yeah. And that was the point I was going to make, that you wrote about that the wisdom of indigenous people also impacted the climate.
That's right. Yeah. We all do.
Yeah.
We all do, right?
And talked about even the earliest farming, that there is a measurable impact on climate. Although I have to say, we're coming out of the Little Ice Age, and I wonder how much might be involved with that process, whether that process might still be ongoing, as opposed to just humans causing everything.
Well, in terms of today, the global warming, I mean, it's really whatever's happening on the geologic time scale, and what's happened in the last 200 years in terms of all of the heat trapping carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous oxide that we've pumped into the atmosphere is absolutely increasing our temperatures. That is really clear. And in fact, as we've started to get at least some of a handle on the situation, some of the really crazy IPCC, you know, that's the UN climate panel, you know, remember like 10, 15 years ago, they were saying that we were going to hit 5 degrees Celsius of global warming. And that would put New York under like 50 feet of water, right? And that's when, you know, you saw some of that kind of scary stuff in Al Gore's original movie. Well, we're not heading for that anymore. That's like, it's not a popular thing to say sometimes in the climate movement. Now we're heading for 3 degrees Celsius, which is still really bad. And there's some bad stuff already happening. But again, it's sort of the extremes tend to dominate the debate. There are some people saying like, it's not happening, it's all natural, or carbon is good. And then you have some people saying like, it's all apocalypse, we're all doomed, euthanize your children tomorrow. And I know that's a bad word. I shouldn't use that on this podcast.
That's all right.
But in any case, I do think like, again, there is some nuance to this stuff.
Yeah. Let's talk about meat because, of course, yeah. Americans are big meat eaters. And had a statistic that kind of surprised me. You said pound for pound, beef generates 50 times more emissions than coal. Now that's kind of a stunning statistic. Where did you get that?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's math. And remember, I mean, of course, like, coal creates a lot more energy than meat produces food. So we use we ate 450 million tons of meat last year. And, we don't use that much coal. So coal is definitely, I do describe like cows in some ways. They're sort of like cow. They're like coal plants with four legs. but of course, a coal plant puts, there aren't that many coal plants and there are 1.5 billion cows. But yeah, I mean, cattle really are the baddie. And so dairy is a problem. It's worse, for the climate than chicken or pork, but at least cattle make milk like several times a day. They make beef only once in their lifetime.
Yes.
And so it's just really, it's really inefficient and it just creates a lot of deforestation. It is the most, by far the leading driver of deforestation globally. And it's the leading land use. I mean, 2/3 of our agricultural land is pasture. And that's just about all for sheep and cows. And then, 3/4 of our agricultural land is supporting livestock in some way, if you include the crops that we feed to livestock. So yeah, it's just, they are the middlemen. And it is true that, eating plants is better for the earth and for the climate than eating animals that eat plants. That said, it is also true. I quoted that one pollster who talked about how restriction taxes or other restrictions on meat are the least popular policy he has ever polled. His quote was that it's up there with veterans benefits for ISIS. So, I don't think there's anything to be gained by, wagging your finger at people and saying you're bad, you're eating too much meat. I personally, because I think meat is awesome. I love it. I've cut beef out of my diet, beef and lamb, because, everybody's got to find the level of hypocrisy that they're comfortable with.
There you go.
And I thought writing a book about food and climate while continuing to eat beef and lamb, that's a tough sell. But still, I still eat chicken and pork. And again, I have solar panels on my roof. They've saved me a lot of money. I drive an electric car. I love it. I fly too much. So I have an impact on the climate. I'm not sitting, perfect usually isn't on the menu, but I do think that better is better than worse. And I think whether or not you want to cut out beef, I'm not, the immediate thing is like, oh, he's trying to ban cheeseburgers. He's trying to ban cows. That's what Trump says all the time. Or he's going to make everybody eat bugs. I'm not saying any of that. I'm just saying, here are some facts. Here is the impact of our diets. And if you want to, try to do better, that's great.
Yeah, you talk about what individuals can do, and we'll get to that. But the thing that I think will really get you in trouble is that—
The one thing?
Yeah, that's right. I think the most trouble, you support factory farming for chickens and pigs. And factory farming is constantly decried by animal rights activists, bioethicists, environmentalists as causing greater problems than just about anything else because of poop pools and this kind of thing, that it's supposedly cruel. Why did you support factory farming? That's a very controversial position to take today.
Yeah. Well, again, like I said, I'm for high yield agriculture. And I don't, when I talk about factory farms, it's, they treat people badly. They treat animals badly. They use too many antibiotics. They do often dump their poop in the river or other places where they shouldn't be dumping it. Their politics are often, pretty unpleasant. They do a They do a lot of work to make sure that they don't have any environmental regulations, and they're certainly fighting climate action in ways that I don't like. But one thing that factories are really good at is manufacturing a lot of stuff. And factory farms are really good at manufacturing a lot of food. And like I said, we're going to need to make, right now, the meat demand is going to go, it's going to increase 70% over the next 25 years. We're going to have to make more food over the next 30 years than we've made over the last 12,000. And so I think this idea that where you see people saying like, we need to shut down every factory farm. I'm like, okay, great. So what's the plan? My feeling is more like there needs to be a kind of grand bargain where we accept what factory farms do, that they make a lot of food, and we try to help them make even more food, that's sort of what industrial agriculture does well. But we really have to start insisting that they make less of a mess. And in fact, we should be investing in technologies and practices where I talk about this a lot in the book. Where there are a lot of ways that they can do it with less mess. Right now, there's just no push for any of that. There's a lot of hand waving. You have vegans saying like, people just need to stop eating meat.
Which you point out isn't going to happen.
Yeah. How's that going? Right.
Yeah.
And then you have the regenerative people saying like, we just need to go from extractive agriculture to regenerative agriculture. And I'm like, okay, yeah. How does that work?
So what is regenerative agriculture?
You know, this is essentially this kind of more natural. This is the kind of stuff that Michael Pollan has written about all the time, where you're not tilling the soil. Although I should mention that people who don't till the soil usually end up using a lot more herbicides to kill their weeds. And then you plant cover crops. And actually, I think cover crops are great, but they do nothing for the climate. You use fewer chemicals. That's part of the idea. And then on the grazing side, there are rotational grazing, sort of basically more managed grazing. That as I went to Brazil and I saw some areas where that, you know, it does not. Part of this whole idea of regenerative agriculture is that it is going to store a lot of carbon in our soil. Kind of all that bad carbon that has been pumped into the atmosphere is going to be magically repatriated underground. And that is just bogus. But there are some of those regenerative grazing practices in particular can help get better beef yields. And that's great. I saw places in the Amazon where they had increased their yields 400%. And that meant they were using only 1/4 as much of the Amazon. So again, this is the argument for factory farms is essentially that, you know, it's a land sparing argument. That
trade-offs.
Exactly. You make more food per acre. You don't need as many acres to make food. And it's in some ways similar to the argument that you're starting to see about housing, where people are saying like, we need more dense housing in, you know, sort of urban areas so that you don't need housing to sprawl out, you know, all the way into rural areas and people commuting an hour and a half. And I think this is similar. If you can make a lot more food in one place, you don't need to eat the rest of the earth.
It also, and I think, I've been accused of supporting factory farms. I actually haven't done that. But what I have done is said, if you're going to feed people in an affordable way in terms of meat, how are you going to do that on old McDonald's farm? You're not. And the answer is, well, then the poorer people don't get to eat meat. Well, I don't think that's an answer because meat is part of our natural diet and it's nutritious and people need meat.
I think this is, you know, when I talk about, I'm so glad you said that. I mean, I endorse every word. And I am starting to talk a little bit about, you know, when I talk about this new land ethic, there's a policy aspect to it too. And part of it does, I'm suggesting that we do need that, you know, there's an argument over cheap food. I was just at Climate Week in New York and you couldn't walk down the street without bumping into some, you know, regenerative panel, some event where you had like a regenerative farmer and an organic chef and then somebody from PepsiCo or General Mills talking about how we need to transform agriculture. And then usually it was the chef would at some point say like, look, people have to understand, you know, you might have to pay a little bit more for your food. And I am saying, no, that is not acceptable. I mean, we just had an election where the main, you know, what people hated most about the incumbent was that food prices were too high. And now today we're seeing food prices that are even higher. We're seeing tariffs that are making food higher, the price of food higher. We're seeing crackdown on migrant labor, but we're seeing the same old, you know, biofuels mandates, the sugar program. And I'm saying that there's an alternative policy approach that's about making food and agriculture affordable and accessible. And it's a little bit less finger pointy, and it's maybe a little bit less woo woo. But I think, you know, we know that when, you know, if you want the prices of something to come down, you need to make more of it. And there is I'm really worried about this global instinct, not only in the environmental community, but the UN, the World Bank, every major philanthropy, like the Rockefeller Foundation. If you just say the word regenerative, money comes flowing out of their wallets. And there's this idea that we don't need to make as much food. We should actually be making less food, but it should be quality food or healthy food. And in fact,
easy for people with a lot of money and live comfortably like me. I mean, I don't have a lot of money, but I live comfortably. I used to buy and still do eggs from cage-free chickens. But I pay $2 to $3 more a dozen for that, which I can do. And I just don't see myself as having the right to say to some person who might be, let's say, a single mother raising two or three kids that doesn't have any, is living month paycheck to paycheck, that she should be spending a lot more money for eggs based on moral browbeating. And you make an extremely good point in your book that moral browbeating doesn't work.
No, that's right. That is true. I mean, another character in my book is this guy who used to be, the head of campaigns for PETA. Right. He used to go around throwing blood at models who were wearing fur, and he streaked Buckingham Palace with "Go Vegan" written on his chest, and basically did it for 20 years. And then he realized it wasn't working. And so now he's the head of the sort of trade group that essentially advocates for alternative proteins, right? Fake meat, whether it's made of plants or,
but you point out isn't working either.
Hasn't worked yet, but the cow is a pretty mature technology, and this stuff isn't.
Right.
And what he has recognized is that we're not going to yell at people. We're not going to yell people into veganism, right? We're not going to say like, hey, do the right thing for the planet. But look at what Tesla did. They just made a better mousetrap. They made an awesome product. They didn't say like, hey, save the earth, buy Tesla. They said, buy Tesla. It's awesome. And it is helping to save the earth. And I think, you know, right now these like the Impossible Burgers, Beyond Burgers, which I don't like at all, but most of them, I think it's a great technological achievement that they've made something that's like 90% as good as meat and is maybe only 50% more expensive. But for most people, that's not a selling point.
Right.
Like, but again, maybe someday I think they will get to be, you know, as good and as cheap as meat. And, you know, you can make it healthier, and then more power to it. I think that's a much like technology. I write about all kinds of technologies in the book, whether it's like fertilizers that use the gene edit microbes to snatch nitrogen out of the air and feed it to crops. I talk about these guys at the University of Illinois who are trying to reinvent photosynthesis with artificial intelligence and big data and modern genomics to increase crop yields. And I really have a lot more confidence in those guys and men and women who are working on these problems, working on the science, working on the technology, than I do on the activists who are kind of like, you're bad, change your behavior. Because like, you know,
and then they take a private jet and go over to Davos and all that.
Well, that too.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're not good at changing our behavior, but we're really good at inventing stuff.
Right.
And so I hope we do.
I think the point you made was quite excellent, is that what Tesla did, what Musk did with Tesla, is he created a product that was so different, and it has an ancillary benefit from the environmentalist perspective, but was better in terms of the planet. I want to, we're almost out of time here, but I want to get into this. What did you mean by produce, reduce, protect, and restore?
Yeah. I mean, that's a, you know, this is, you know, we've talked a little bit about policies at the national level about how we should be, you know, doing the research and investing in these potential technologies and then deploying the actual technologies that can work, that we should be stopping biofuels, and that we should really be promoting these kind of high yield, whether it's through gene editing or, you know, reinventing photosynthesis or what have you, that we really need to be trying to make more food with less land. That's really important. But then some people will point out, and it is true that if you're a farmer in, say, a farmer in Africa, and you get more fertilizer and you get better seeds, so you actually can improve your yields, the first thing you're going to do is go cut down more trees. and to expand your farm. So there is this kind of wicked problem where we need higher yields worldwide. So as a species, we can make more food with less land, but we have to get to that place. Can't just every time we increase yields, you know, that could create local environmental disasters. And so that's where this idea of produce and protect, comes in. I mean, right now, the global approach to deforestation and meat and agriculture and everything, it just sucks. I mean, it's just, there are $300 billion of global agricultural subsidies every year. And it's mostly just giving money to farmers because they're farmers. There are no strings attached. And then there are some international efforts to reduce deforestation where it's like, we'll give money to somebody to basically put a fence around a particular piece of forest. But of course, then somebody will, it's like, okay, well, then we'll just farm the next piece of forest, or, you know, or the forest will burn down, or there's no consistent approach. And when you say produce and protect, there the idea is, the simple way of putting it is, let's give money to these low-income countries, these developing countries that have more primitive farming, but also incredible natural resources, and basically say, we will help you produce more. We will help your farmers become a much more stable and viable industry, but you're going to have to do it on the land that they already have. You're going to have to protect your forests. And if the forests come down, the money stops. So it's a way of combining the carrots with the sticks in the ways that we really haven't. And I think, you know, even in the United States, we have all carrots for agriculture and no sticks. Yeah. And I think we really have to start thinking about producing, protecting, and as you mentioned, also reducing, which means essentially eating less beef, and restoring, taking some of the really marginal farmland that doesn't produce a lot of food, but could really be store a lot of carbon, and trying to return some of that to nature.
Your last chapter is How to Save the World. And in that chapter, you get into what individuals can do, understanding that an individual isn't going to change the totality of the circumstance, but that if enough individuals decide to act, the totality of the circumstance can be changed. What are, just really quick, a few of the things that listeners can do if they're interested in this problem?
I mean, that's absolutely right, right? I mean, I will say that the Project Drawdown, which is this group of scientists, they've ranked the 100 top opportunities for emissions reductions, and two of the top five are moving towards plant-forward diets and reducing food waste, right? And those are individual things, right? Those are things individuals can do. And when we waste about a quarter of our food, and that means we waste a quarter of the farmland that's used to grow that food, right? We use a landmass the size of China to grow garbage. Wow. So, you know, try to do less of that. It really is eat less beef, waste less food. If I had to do a third one, sometimes I say eat even less beef, or don't feed your pets beef and lamb, because those really are the big ones. But again, even if the rich world ate 50% less beef and the entire world wasted 50% less food, we still are going to have to make more food with less land. So totally. It is true that, individuals can't solve everything, but, the average American eats the equivalent of 3 burgers a week. And if we only ate 2, we would save a landmass the size of Massachusetts every year. So I think it's a drop in the bucket, but drops fill buckets.
And that's right. I like that line that you had in the book. We're out of time. The book is We Are Eating the Earth, and Michael Grunwald is the author. And the subtitle is The Race to Fix Our Food System and Save Our Climate. Michael, it's very interesting talking to you. Congratulations on a really thorough job. If anyone's interested in the sometimes seemingly intractable issues that we're dealing with in this field, highly recommend the book. You did a terrific job. What next for you, by the way?
Well, I think, you know, I've been in my cave working on this for 5 years. Yeah. So I think I'm going to be writing about these issues for a while. You know, it's, yeah. Climate's a little hot these days, and food, you know, food with the MAHA movement. There seems to be a lot going on there. So I'm trying to dive in.
Very good. Thank you for being with me. And maybe we'll talk again soon.
I really appreciate it. This was fun.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.